Frames of Reference.
Three films, two cinephiles, one podcast.
Cinema is my secret passion.
It's a foreign movie. A film is what it is.
But art films make people feel funny.
This film was a personal vision, not a marketing machine.
We're getting too many mainstream movies.
Episode 5, The World of Demi.
Well, hello again.
Welcome back. We've made it to yet another episode.
Against all odds, we're here.
Yes, should probably introduce ourselves. I'm Kyle Mahaney. I'm a film restoration tech and post-production guy, also at times a filmmaker.
I'm Sarah Page, a recent college graduate, cellist, and casual film goer, but trying to get more into film, cinema, and talk about it more critically.
This is Frames of Reference, the show where we talk about three movies in comparison by movement, director, or theme. And this week, we're talking about the work of Jacques Demy, a very underappreciated component of the French New Wave, who brought a colorful and vibrant look in his response to the American musicals in the 1950s. We will be looking at The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and The Young Girls of Rochefort, very, very iconic musicals that are very different in style from each other. And then we'll be comparing that to Damien Chazelle's La La Land from 2016, which is in many ways a pastiche of Demy's style. And he has described La La Land as an attempt at remaking a film in the image of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. So Jacques Demy is often overlooked as a component of the French New Wave because his movies are so vibrant and colorful. He was part of the left bank of the French New Wave, along with filmmakers like his wife, Agnès Varda. But he tends to take a more traditional approach to the grand productions that the French Wave is often seen as being a response to. So we see this melding of auteur ideas and a real sense of individuality in his films. We see things like a continuous cast of characters that pop up in his films. We see things like the political messaging of his films, or the ways in which he uses a subjective lens to portray things, but also the color and pop and grandiose design of the more traditional French cinema of the era. He's heavily influenced by the kind of Fox musicals in the 1950s that were happening in America. The fact that Gene Kelly pops up in Young Girls of Rochefort is no coincidence. And it's really a unique part of this movement that doesn't fit into the neatly designed boxes that people often look at when we're talking about the movement as a whole. It's easy to minimize how political he is, for example, because he uses subtlety and he uses allegory.
Yeah, I really loved both of these movies. This was my first time seeing any Jacques Demy films. I'll admit I haven't really seen a lot of foreign films, including French cinema. But I love both of these movies. They were both tonally very different from each other.
Yeah.
But Umbrellas of Cherbourg had this beautiful sadness and poise to it that was so deeply emotional. And then Young Girls of Rochefort was so like happy and beautiful and bright. And both of them were just so evocative. I loved both of them.
Cherbourg has this profound sadness that is also so realist. It's almost hopeful because it's so relatable. They're just absolute gems. These are some of my favorite films of all time, quite frankly. Which does not fit with the rest of my cinema taste, so it's always a bit of an oddity. Shall we dive right in with Cherbourg?
So The Umbrellas of Cherbourg came out in 1964 and was directed by Jacques Demy. The music was composed by Michel Legrand, who also composed the Thomas Crown Affair, Cleo from 5 to 7, and the musical Yentl. Catherine Deneuve stars as Genevieve Emery and Nino Casanuevo as Guy Faucher. It had a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's available from Criterion on Blu-ray and in a box set with many of Demy's films. It's also on the Criterion channel, and you can also find it on Max streaming. It's also screening at the BFI this month.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not available on physical media or streaming anywhere in the UK outside of those screenings at the BFI. But if you're in the Greater London area, there's like 4 screenings, and it's seeing this film projected is a wonderful experience. The film premiered at Cannes in 1964. This is kind of like the final saga of conflict between the Cannes Film Festival and the French New Wave. It won the award that we now call the Palme d'Or. At the time, it was called the Grand Prix du Festival International du Film. It went on to win the Prix Louis de Luc, which is another notable French industry award. In America, it was nominated for the Academy for the Best Foreign Language Film, also for Best Song for I Will Wait for You, Best Original Score, Best Scoring of Adaptation or Treatment, and Best Screenplay Written Directly for the Screen. So it did very well in the awards season. It was also adapted to the stage for a brief, largely unsuccessful West End musical run. So when we're framing this film, this is often considered to be a part of a trilogy of romances with his first film, Lola, and with the young girls of Rochefort. However, that's a bit of an odd pairing. It's really just his three most popular films because he made many other romances very much like this, and Lola is not a musical. So it's kind of odd that we single out these three, but I'll take it. You know, they're all wonderful films. And the restorations that we see today and survive in their wonderful, vibrant state are really the credit of his wife, Agnès Varda, and Michel Legrand, who were able to, in the 90s, really care about preservation and ensure that the color separation masters, which are basically a black and white copy of each color of the film, were preserved and scanned so that the fading we see in a lot of movies this era did not affect them and were able to enjoy them at this quality. So the preservation of Jacques Demy's work really is Agnès Varda's achievement. So what's the movie actually about?
The movie is split into three parts. Part one, The Departure, which takes place in November of 1957. Part two, The Absence, which covers from January to April in 1958. And part three, The Return, which goes from March 1959 to December of 1963. Our story follows, or begins really, with two young people in love. Genevieve, who is living with her mother, Madame Emery, they run like an umbrella shop together.
This is a real shop in Cherbourg.
This is a real shop in Cherbourg.
You can go there.
We have to go there. Okay. And Genevieve is in love with Guy, who is this young, handsome mechanic who is living with his godmother, Elise. And Genevieve's mother disapproves, as with many a romance, but Guy and Genevieve are having none of it. They're going to get married. They've even planned. They're going to name their first child Francois.
They're teenagers.
They don't care. And then another character who's introduced is Madeleine, who is a young woman who looks after Guy's aunt, who is secretly in love with Guy. This act ends very dramatically with Guy being drafted to serve in the Algerian War. The night before he leaves, he and Genevieve pledge their undying love to one another and also have their first time together, which has some consequences.
Again, this is 1957?
Yeah, this is 1957 in November. So context of the times is important to consider. Genevieve learns that she is pregnant and writes to Guy, but he is, you know, at war. Like, he's not writing letters very consistently and communicating very consistently. And her mother tells her that she should give up on Guy, that he's moved on from her. And another character is introduced in this act, Roland Cassard, who is important to he's a character from the film Lola, which is another connection to when we talk about these three films being kind of a trilogy.
It's a French New Wave standard that a filmmaker should have like a rogues gallery of characters throughout all their movies of showing up again. In Lola, Roland Cassard is a young drifter who's kind of aimlessly going through life, who winds up getting caught up in diamond smuggling. By the time we see him here, he is a successful diamond dealer. The film doesn't really comment on how legitimate that business is, but he's very successful and wealthy.
Yeah, we don't get a lot of insight into Roland. He has like one part where he sings about his first love, Lola, and then the kind of the rest of his character is him being in love with Genevieve. But, you know, so yeah, we don't know. We don't know how legit his diamond business is going, but he seems to be doing very well for himself. And he is courting Genevieve.
And really, everyone in the diamond business in the 60s is a crook. It's just a matter of how much you're a crook.
That is true. So Madame Emery really wants Roland and Genevieve to get married. She wants Genevieve to give up on Guy. And Genevieve is kind of dealing with this pressure about, you know, who to marry. But it's more intense than that because she has to choose between this love that she has for Guy And what is the logical correct choice, which would be Roland, a man who, like, literally really does not give her a reason to say no. Even though she's pregnant with Guy's child, he's like, Roland is like, we'll raise it as our own. Like, I will love this child and we will be happy together. And so in the end of the act, Genevieve decides to marry Roland and we move to the returned. Guy returns injured from war to find that Genevieve has married and left Cherbourg for good, and he has a difficult time readjusting to civilian life. He quits his job, goes drinking, has just a really bad time.
He's traumatized.
He is.
He has intense PTSD, and the film doesn't spell that out, but
the film doesn't spell it out and does not spend a lot of time, but it's clear he has PTSD. He is struggling. He has, like, basically a night of, quote unquote, of an all-time low where he, like, quits his job, goes drinking in a bar, gets into an argument with the bartender, and then spends the night with a prostitute. And then he returns to his apartment in this final sort of downward spiral, and Madeleine tells him that his Aunt Elise has died. This is when Guy kind of has a turnaround moment where he realizes that Madeleine is in love with him, and he, like, together, they rebuild his life. So he opens a gas station and he gets married to Genevieve and they have a child. They have a son that they name Francois. And at the end of the movie, they're very happy together.
They're in love. It's not the fiery passion of his love with Genevieve.
It's a different kind of love.
They're happy.
Yeah. And they're like, Genevieve shows up unexpectedly because she goes to get gas because she's been passing through Cherbourg, and she has her and Guy's child with them in the car, who's also been named Francois.
In real life, that is Agnès Varda's daughter, who was adopted and raised by Jacques Demy, in some ways contrasting the story we see here.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. And then Madeleine has left with her son, Francois, right when Genevieve with the daughter, Francois, pulls up. And Guy and Genevieve have this very kind of uncomfortable, like when you see someone that you used to know so well, but now you are lost touch with, they have this very stiff, barely words exchanged conversation where they try to talk, but they can't find any words to cover the time that has passed. Because there has been a gap. There's been like a 5-year gap, I think.
But there's also so much pain and communication in the body language there.
Yeah, there's like a longing and a desire to say something, a desire to clear the air. You get the sense that Genevieve wants to say something, but she can't because there really isn't anything you can say when it's been this long.
And they've also both found peace and they're not. Yeah.
Yeah. So they kind of have this brief conversation. Genevieve asks if Guy wants to speak to his daughter. And he goes, I don't wish to, basically almost signifying like, I'm okay with you having a separate life. We can have a separate life. And then Genevieve drives away and the film ends with Guy and his family at the gas station.
Yeah. Whew. It's such a simple, beautiful little film of, you can say it's a film about compromise, but also it's about finding happiness in those compromises.
It is. And it's also a film about, in many ways, growing up with your love. You're very young and you're in love, it's a very like different kind of like passion and fire and like
it's
us against the world.
Dreams and horniness.
Yeah. And then as you get older, your lives also diverge very often when you get older from the people that you are close with when you're younger. So in a way, while these two were in like an actual romantic love, in any kind of relationship with anyone you know when you're younger, when time passes and you see them again, there is this divergence and this distance. And sometimes it's hard to like say, not always, but people grow apart.
I also love the way it portrays Genevieve's choices, because there is definitely some stuff going on here with class mobility. And she makes a choice that is harmful to Guy. You know, she doesn't break it off cleanly. She doesn't really communicate. She just stops responding and gets married. And she doesn't go out of her way to make his child available to him earlier in her life. But she makes the choice that gives her peace and happiness. So it's a selfish choice, but it's a choice that allows her to have stability and joy. So it's a compromise that causes harm, but they've both caused each other harm.
Yeah, I think with Genevieve, I always thought it was very interesting at a part where Genevieve's mother says, like, to Roland when he asks for her Genevieve's hand, she says, oh, I don't want to pressure my daughter. And then Roland goes, Genevieve will choose of her own choice or whatever. And then, like, in the next scene, her mother's pressuring her to get married to him.
Well, her mother's of a merchant class, so kind of straddling this between wealth and poverty, but her business is failing. We see this consistently. Her business is not doing well.
And she wants her daughter to be happy and be provided for as well. It's not just a, it's not a greedy thing. It's more of a, I want you to be in a, yeah, I want you to be in a good place. I think as well, when we think about like classes and choices, Genevieve is in kind of a impossible choice because for her being a young woman who is pregnant and being unmarried as well, she's in a very difficult position. And so it would almost be crazy for her not to get married to Roland when he offers not just stability, but a future of any kind.
And he doesn't care about her pregnancy. He's willing to be a father figure to her child. At this time, Guy is in the Algerian War, an incredibly deadly conflict where you don't know that he's coming back.
Exactly. So I just think it's interesting that the narrative doesn't frame Genevieve, like doesn't villainize her for choosing not to be with Guy. And I think the viewer would be mistaken to villainize her for choosing not to be with Guy.
This is also very, very French in contrast to the American musicals that inspired this kind of film, where they would judge her. They would want a more traditional nuclear family in the narrative. Here it's saying, no, they're able to live fulfilling lives of happiness with this blended family, with this, you know, compromise, with this, you know, second love.
Yeah. And again, how many options did Genevieve have? Not many.
There's a unspoken element at one point in this film. Abortion was illegal in France at this time, not only in 1958 when it takes place, but also in 1964. Abortion wasn't legalized in France until the mid-70s. And when she first tells her mother that she's pregnant, it's almost hanging in the air of the conversation back and forth they're having, because she doesn't have a safe option.
I think it's very interesting that the two older important figures in Guy and Genevieve's lives are both women. Guy's has a really close relationship with his godmother, Elise, who doesn't have a lot of screen time, but the clear love and bond that they have for one another and a true sense of family.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's so beautiful. And it, you can feel it come right off the screen. And in its own unique way, Genevieve and her mother also have a very deep and loving relationship, but there's a more, that more fraught mother-daughter relationship that has its own complications as Genevieve is learning, growing into a womanhood and, you know, figuring out her life. Because Genevieve's only 16.
Yeah.
At the beginning of this film. I don't know if we clarified her exact age, but she's very young. So she and her mother are butting heads in a unique way, but they care for each other very deeply. And I do really love those important figures that these women have.
It's also important to compare that to Demi's own life, which Anya Svarda beautifully captured in her biopic about Demi, Jacques, is Demi's father, who was a somewhat conflicting and distant figure in his life, owned a service station during his childhood. And he was much closer with his mother because his father wanted him to follow that trade instead of pursuing the arts. So this is the kind of maternal support that really parallels what we know about Demi's own childhood experiences.
It's really interesting seeing the flavors of Demi's life infused into these movies. And it's beautiful. More people should talk about the things that they know, because it's just, it's lovely.
Which that is the French New Wave, you know, portray the world around you, portray your own experience in your characters. I mentioned that Varda made a biopic about her husband after he passed away from what we now know was AIDS. She also made a beautiful documentary the year after that about his life, which really explores all of his films and how they related to his childhood experiences, his experiences during the war, his experiences in military service, and his love that he found with Agnes and his love he found with others.
So in terms of production, what makes this film unique?
Well, you got to look at the French New Wave was known for these very small productions that were designed to move very quickly and very dynamically, often shot in black and white, often moving very handheld with the camera, lots of action happening with not much planning. Demy here is taking the character and writing and directorial traits of this movement and then emulating a giant, you know, musical production with color, with beautiful matte paintings, with grand scope. He's treating the city of Cherbourg as if it is a studio backlot. He's painted everything with these vibrant, amazing colors. He's using Eastman color film, which allows him to really convey this intense, intense color palette. And it's almost like a violent reaction to the realism of the French New Wave. It's got these grand numbers. There's really nothing to compare it to because it is shot on real locations. They are working with production sound. They are working within real world locations, but then the entire thing is sung through as an opera. You know, every line is dubbed over by vocalists. Every bit of it is intensely, minutely produced. So you have this real melding of ideals. It's also fairly unique as a jazz opera. It doesn't really fit into any of the boxes of what we would traditionally look at. We have this incredible music. It's not a traditional musical in the American style where people pause to experience a musical number. The entire story is sung through, and we are not meant to really acknowledge that it is being sung as a musical number. It's merely the way in which the characters are conveying their dialogue.
It's amazing to me how like minute and detailed this film is, and the way that, you know, it's shot on real locations, real places. It has that concrete realness to it, but at the same time, with the colors, the costumes, the meticulous details, it's so
It looks
whimsical,
incredible,
and abstract as well. It's so idealized, and so it's real. It looks so beautiful, like it's so lovely, but at the same time, it has that realness to it as well.
The closing shot of the film is the shot of Guy's gas station. And every time I see that in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, that's a beautiful set. And then I remember, no, that's an actual gas station in Cherbourg. It just looks so picturesque with the snow falling on it. It's perfectly, like, it's painted beautifully. Everything is incredibly stylized despite being real life.
That is a beautiful shot. One of the shots that stands out to me when I think back is when in Act One, when Genevieve says goodbye to Guy, and he gets up onto the train, and then the train, we leave with the train as the viewer, and we zoom out and we see the sign that says Cherbourg, and the soundtrack is swelling, and she is like crying, and it's
cinema. It's pure cinema.
So good.
It's interesting because a lot of French New Wave films were very low budget because it allowed them to be very dynamic and move around a lot. To me, this film is significantly higher budget than a lot of his contemporaries. But he used the technological advances of having smaller, lighter cameras, smaller sound gear, et cetera, to allow himself to bring this massive scope production to real world locations instead of bringing a very small production to any real world location.
We'd also be remiss to talk about this movie without talking about the soundtrack, which is...
Yeah, Michel Legrand. There is music under every moment of the film, continuously. And, you know, we describe it as an opera. It's an opera. It's just perfect. It conveys so much of the emotion of the film, and at times it is bold and it, you know, brings this anthem to it. At other times, it's very subtle. Legrand is famously quoted as saying that music in cinema should not be a smokescreen to hide the mistakes of the filmmaker, but it's an integral part of the art process, which now we would say, yeah, of course, especially in a musical. But in the early 60s, the score was often a little bit of an afterthought for these movies. And we're starting to see, especially in Europe, this be taken more seriously. You know, this is the era of Bernard Herrmann. We just talked about Psycho last week. You're starting to see a real focus be put on the art of the score. And the score is always at the forefront of this movie.
What I love about musical films and what I love about this movie is the way that, because it's sung all the way through, every line is sung because it's an opera, basically, is the line between what is soundtrack, what is accompanying, what is for the listener, and what is reality, what is happening for the characters, is very blurred and yep. almost a fourth wall breaking kind of thing, where the characters are interacting with the music, and that makes it rich and beautiful. And the absolute commitment to the emotions of the songs and the emotions of the music is what sells you in those scenes.
You are never in a doubt of what emotions the characters are feeling as they are describing their reactions in song. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, I loved it. I will definitely be rewatching it.
Buy the Criterion box set. It is the best value you can get on Blu-ray. On sale, it goes to like $40 for 6 Jacques Demy films. It's just, it's joy. It's joy in a box.
joy in a box. That's good.
The film was not expected to be a success. It was kind of viewed as a big gamble. The story of how it was made is actually really interesting, because Demy struggled for years to get funding for this film. In fact, he went and made 2 films in between trying to get this film made. He made Lola and he made Bay of Angels, which are both very low budget black and white films. They're not musicals. They don't have the kind of production scale that we see in Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Trying to get funding, and eventually he appealed to a prominent newspaper publisher, Pierre Lazareff, who put pressure on French cinemas, as well as connecting Demy with a producer to fund the film. At the time, in the climate, it was considered to be a likely flop. The distributors would only agree to 3 weeks in their cinemas. That's, you know, not enough to make back the budget of this movie. In reality, it stayed continuously in French cinemas for 7 months straight. It played extensively in the US. It played very well in the UK. It's become one of these like defining films of France, when a lot of other films of that era did not reach American or British audiences.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me where they're like, oh, you can only get 3 weeks, and that was only after like intense pressure, fighting. You know, to get it actually, you know.
The history of available. Pierre Lazareff is interesting. He's not the character you want pissed at you.
And then it just has this incredibly successful run, like it's almost like perfect drama in reality, the perfect story to go with it. You know, you fight to get it shown and then it does very well.
And in many ways, it's a generational film because, you know, we have a lot of young French people who are right back from the Algerian War, which had just ended the year before, I believe. It really was the voice of a young generation that wasn't being spoken to by the costume dramas that were associated with the tradition of quality, which is the term used to describe the kind of the filmmaking establishment of France at the time. You know, sure, they have the French New Wave, they have Godard, they have Varda, they have all these very scrappy movies that are beautiful and tell these stories that connect with them, but no one else was really making these grand productions like Demy. And he really touches on the lived experience, both of those who went to war and those who are left behind. And that, I think, is the true staying power of the movie.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that we never follow Guy's experiences in the conflict. It's very much like a what was it you like don't at have home to. Kind of thing, but the weight of...
You see him come back, yeah, and that tells you everything.
Yeah, like the... It all taking place in Cherbourg, that we only see characters when they're there. If they're not there, then we don't follow them. And so when Guy comes back with the weight of his experiences with him, you didn't need to see it to know about it. But again, I think it's interesting that you followed people from the perspective of the town that they're in. And we didn't follow him or follow Genevieve when she left. We stayed.
All we get are his letters, which say a pretty dark story about the Algerian War. Obviously, that was famously horrible. We also can kind of infer a lot from the tone of how people are discussing him leaving. You know, it's not even a likely return that he returns intact. It's an incredibly bloody conflict. And then we get this full picture of the trauma, the survivor's guilt, the uprootedness that he experiences when he returns.
Yeah, I almost wish we could have spent a little bit more time with Guy, because I found him to be a very interesting character. But he is, in fact, absent in the middle part of the film. I did almost want to...
Which almost makes him stronger as a character, because he's still dominating so much of the...
It is. And the framing narrative. Of the narrative surrounds Guy. He departs in part one. The absence is in his absence. And then the return follows his return. The like steps and parts of the story do deeply hinge on him.
And when he returns, we have an absence of Genevieve, and we're able to still palpably feel that absence as he's coming to terms with his new life. One thing that really resonates with me is in the film, Guy's mother says people only die of love in the movies. And in that way, Demi is commenting on the kinds of perfect, idealized relationships that we often see in the kinds of Hollywood movies he's emulating. When in reality, none of these characters wind up with that kind of relationship. We see compromises. We see choices made that will harm each other. We see pain. And in the end, we're kind of left to question what love means. Are they in love, or are they settling for something that looks like love?
Yeah, it's interesting that I personally feel like this movie doesn't give you a clear indication of what quote unquote, the correct love story would have been.
No, it makes no judgment.
Exactly. It makes no judgment on the events. Sometimes you watch a romance film and it's very clear who the correct choice is or who the ideal couple is or whatever. But in this movie, it's very like, here are some people who loved each other. And then here are people that each of those people came to love or wound up with. However you want to translate that. You know, are they making compromise? Are they happy? Like, is love a choice that you make every day to be in love, to love? Or is it this vague ideal that doesn't require any work, that just sort of comes and goes easily?
And it's easy to compare this to the works of his wife, Agnes Varda, who made a number of films on similar issues with a much more cynical perspective. In One Sings, the Other Doesn't, we have a story that is set about the same time. It's set in the early 60s. The Algerian War also plays a role here. We have a young person who is pregnant. And the result there is she goes off to obtain a dangerous back alley abortion. So there are different ways to look at this story. And the way Varda frames love and the way Demi frames love, while they are ultimately discussing the same issues, and I think they have mostly the same views, they're... approach of cynicism versus kind of this dreamy optimism are radically different in how things are conveyed.
Yeah, the movie, like Cherbourg, is a very, at the end of the day, you know, while it talks about kind of presses on these like heavier topics, it's still a very light movie that's not intended to make you feel profoundly sad or profoundly heavy when it's done. It's a very like, yeah, here's a spoonful of sugar with the medicine sort of kind of thing, where, you know, those deeper ideas are there for you to pull at if you want to, including, I would say, even by extension, those deeper ideas are there with the war in Algeria as well. If you wanted to, you could watch this movie and maybe not really consider.
Or even criticism of the French government is perfectly throughout this film as well.
Yeah. Like, if you want to just watch this movie at face value, you can, but there's a lot of really interesting threads to pull on.
The film takes place during an economic downturn. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of political subtext here, but you can just enjoy the movie as well. It invites a deeper reading, but it doesn't require it. You also have the fact that Demi is a queer filmmaker. He was never out in his life, but he was in an open relationship with his wife, and he was interested in men. And I think the way this film frames relationships makes it an interesting thing to keep in mind that he was queer. He was attracted to men. He had many male lovers in this time, and we're presented with this fairly rigidly heteronormative view about a man as a breadwinner. And what does that mean? And what does marriage mean? Is marriage a source of financial security for a woman? Is marriage a source of love? Does love matter in marriage? And so he's playing with a lot of ideas that I think were idealized for him, but were never quite his own reality. You know, he married a woman who they had a profound, deep appreciation for each other, and they were able to build this life. They were not their first loves. Agnes had a previous child from another relationship. They'd been through a lot together. They both had other partners. There's a lot of elements that contrast when this story looks like his own life in an idealized world, and then he contrasts that with the ways that he built a very happy, fulfilling existence for himself. That goes against the grain of the tale Cherbourg is telling us.
Yeah, in a way, in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, the relationships are a little simpler, you know, with mm-hmm. two people in love, and then those two people end up with two other people. But the emotion and some of the circumstances you can like draw parallels to without, which I think is very interesting, how you can explore emotions and experiences of your reality in the guise of like a heteronormative, like couples falling in love with one another in a musical, yeah. You know?
And I mean, there's 1,000 queer readings also on like forbidden love and love that can't be. So that's, yeah. That's an element there.
I don't know if this might be reaching, but you know, Genevieve and Guy, who fall in love with one another in the movie to begin with, are considered by outsiders to the relationship as a, you know, forbidden love, as a not.
It's crossing class lines.
Crossing class lines. It goes against the normative values of the society. And so the way that Guy and Genevieve don't end up with one another, you could put, I think, a queer reading onto that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Also, you have, you know, how are women portrayed here? We have kind of mixed messages because we see an independent shopkeeper. There is no father in the picture for either of these characters. So, and we see Genevieve's mother is an independent shop owner, but she still kind of insists that Genevieve needs a man. We have some really complicated messages going on. There is no father figure in the entire movie outside of Roland and Guy at the end. You do not see, you see independent women who live a fulfilling experience. And at the end of the day, Genevieve is still consistently told that she needs a man.
She is. Well, also marriage is, you know, a very economic proposition for a woman. So yeah. Yes, she's told she needs a man, but it's also like, you need to think about the economics of this sort of thing as well that she's experiencing. But it is interesting that Madame Emily is her own independent self, is running this shop, but then is like, she almost doesn't want that life for Genevieve. I think she even says explicitly that she does not want Genevieve to live the life she's had.
She doesn't want Genevieve to take over the shop. She doesn't want that. And it's almost countercultural because we have this, you know, post-war move of women entering industry, being entrepreneurs. We're starting to see a lot of that in France. And her mother really embodies that, but doesn't want that for her own child. So is this projecting her own ideals for what her life could have been? Is it her just wanting an easy, stable life for her daughter? You know, there's a lot to question about the values that are presented to Genevieve as her options.
Yeah, we don't really get a lot of insight into Genevieve's life after she makes her choice. And we don't ever see her mother again after the wedding. And so we don't ever really get that insight into her mother. You know, what were her reasonings? Why did she encourage Genevieve the way that she did or discourage her the way that she did?
And is Genevieve truly happy at the end, or is she just saying she's happy? We don't know.
We don't know.
But you know what is happy?
Cue emotional music as you zoom out on a service station in the snow and you're like, oh my.
It is one of the most iconic shots of all time.
No.
It
is lovely. Lovely and sad. But you know what is lovely and not so sad?
The young girls of Rochefort.
Good vibes. No thoughts, just vibes.
So this is really a more traditional answer to the kinds of 1950s Fox musicals. This is a true musical. The characters break out in fully danced musical numbers repeatedly. We have a large ensemble cast. This is, you know, Gene Kelly is cast as a character here. That is a direct nod to the kinds of 1950s musicals that Demille is infatuated with. The Young Girls of Rochefort came out in 1967. It is a grand CinemaScope production, massive in scope. Umbrellas of Cherbourg had been very successful, so this is kind of him just throwing everything out of production. Again, he's reunited with his longtime collaborator, Michel Legrand, who composes all the music. We also see a return of Catherine Deneuve, now a very successful actress. She plays Delphine, and her sister, Solange, is played by her real-life sister, Francoise Darlac, who unfortunately was on the rise as a star as well and was killed in a fiery car crash just a few months after the movie. We also see George Chakiris, who, as Etienne, who is in West Side Story, very clearly a big visual influence on this movie. There's so much going on here. It is it is just a joyful ensemble of big musical numbers and large-scale choreography. The film has a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's available from Criterion on Blu-ray and in a box set with all of Demille's films. It's also streaming on the Criterion channel on Max. It is not available in the UK. The production actually shot simultaneously with an overdub in English for the songs. And when it was released in the US, that was the only way it was made available. It bombed horribly, and the film wasn't available in its original language until years later. And we have very few surviving clips of that original English dub. There's a lot going on visually here. It's even more stylized compared to Cherbourg. The paintings of Raoul Dufy were very clearly brought as an inspiration throughout, and you can see that. And once again, this was all preserved thanks to the dedication of Varda and Legrand, who were able to really undertake preserving the colors of this movie in the 90s. What's it about?
It's about love, in short, but in a more complicated sense.
In a much lighter way.
In a much lighter way. And I really, really enjoy the way that is love is presented in a lighter way. In a way, there's a lot of characters in this movie, and they're all looking for love. Mm-hmm. And the story just follows them sort of moving throughout their day-to-day lives, looking for love, almost meeting the
different one. Different kinds of love.
And missing, yeah. And missing those people.
If you love, you know, On the Town, An American in Paris, Singing in the Rain, these kinds of, like, Fox musicals, usually starring Gene Kelly, this is a love letter to all of that kind of filmmaking. And it's a very French response to that.
Going off of the idea about it being about different types of love, because getting into spoilers, but there's kind of three main couples that we are building up to the formation of throughout the film. I think that's kind of the best way to describe it. And one is about the love that you have and that you lose. And it follows two older characters who were in love once, but then had a missed connection and hasn't seen each other for years. It's about love at first sight. Two young people meet each other by chance and then are just absolutely head over heels in love with one another for the rest of the film, trying to find one another again. And then there's the love that you could have, but you always seem to miss. which is two characters who the narrative frames as being perfect for one another, and yet they never meet on screen, and we are left to wonder if they ever do.
Yeah.
To get into more of the minutia, because there's a lot of like small moving parts in this movie, even though I would describe it as a no thoughts, just vibes movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like characters moving in and out of the story, a lot of very bright colors and a lot of personality brought to each of the scenes. But the story follows a caravan of trucks are visiting the French seaside town of Rochefort, and they are coming for like a festival event.
Can we just call it a carnival is coming to town? Like
the carnival's coming to town.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we meet Etienne and Bill, who are the two carny workers who we get this lovely dance number at the beginning featuring all the members of the caravan. And they're having an absolute blast as they come into town. And then we kind of move away from them and we are introduced to Solange and Delphine, who are teachers at a music school, basically. So Solange is accompanies on piano while Delphine teaches ballet. And we get a lovely musical number where they introduce themselves to the audience. And it is so catchy that
iconic.
I was singing it at work today under my breath.
I've been singing it all week.
Yeah, no, it's so catchy. And Delphine and Solange, they are twins who are they're fraternal twins, and they want to make it big in Paris. They want to leave their more simple life behind and become these big, successful stars.
Delphine wants to become a famous dancer, and Solange has dreams of composing and is, you know, making quite advanced work on building out her music.
Yeah, so once we've been introduced to their wants, they also have another deep want, which is to fall in love. They sing a lot about the people they want to fall in love with, and honestly, I'm here for the whole time. So once we are introduced to them, Delphine goes and ends up breaking up with the man she's been seeing for a little while. He's wildly in love with her. She's kind of meh, whatever about him.
Ends definitively on her terms.
Yeah, she ends it. And when you were talking about how there was a concurrent English dub, mm-hmm. I can understand why that bombed, because all of these songs are best sung in French. They are yes. designed and composed for the French language, especially the song I feel like that she sings to Guillaume, who is the man she's breaking up with. He is an art.
It is so perfect.
Yeah, he owns an art gallery. And the song that she sings, it's so fast moving. And the words, like, you couldn't translate to that to English and have it sound better.
Honestly, it's almost hard to follow the subtitles for that song.
No, I was working really hard reading those, but watching it a second time around, I watched it twice this week because I liked it so much. Yeah, it just stands out to you. Like, there's no, these songs have to be in French. But anyway, she breaks up with the man she's been seeing, who is this, he owns an art gallery, and she sees in the gallery a painting of a beautiful blonde woman, and she wants to know who painted it. And Guillaume is feeling really salty about being just broken up with, so he doesn't tell her.
Well, also, this beautiful blonde woman is, you know, very, very, it is very clearly her.
Yeah. Like, it's her, but she's never met the man who's painted it, and he's never met her. And so the love story goes on. So Solange goes to see her friend Simon Dam, who owns a music shop, and she wants him to write a letter of recommendation to a friend of his from his music conservatory days, American composer Andy Miller, who is doing a series of recitals in Paris. And while she is there, Simon tells about a romantic past that he had with an important woman in his life, but she left him because she couldn't stand his last name, which is very much as a joke. She couldn't stand the idea of being called Madame Dam, which is a fun play on words. This is an important detail for later when Yvonne, who is the mother of the twins, is telling, well, we're getting ahead of ourselves here.
Yeah. Well, that's a moving part we'll come back to.
Yeah, we'll do a little wraparound. So Solange also shares a piece of music that she's composed with Simon, and he absolutely loves it. And he tells her he'll write the letter. and she leaves. And then we kind of move again. Again, there's a lot of characters in this story, and we're picking up little parts of their lives and how their lives intersect. So we meet Yvonne, who we met a little bit earlier in the movie when the two carnies who first arrived went to go get a little drink in her cafe. But she is the twins' mother.
Yeah, she's the twins' mother. She also has a young son who we'll meet later. And she owns the cafe in the middle of the town square. So she's very much the intersection point for a lot of the situations in the film. She has a number of regular customers. Maxence, who is the Navy sailor, who's almost out of his military service, who is the painter who has painted this painting of the idealized woman. And he is seeking his idealized woman as he views her. He never actually shows this painting to Yvonne. So she doesn't connect the resemblance to her daughter, who she's trying to find a man for. We also start to see the relationship she has with these carnies.
And Yvonne, it's important to note, is she stays in her cafe throughout the entire movie until the very end. She does not leave it. That's one of her big emphases, is that the world comes to her. She doesn't go out to the world.
Yeah, she needs people to run her errands because she has to man the cafe.
Exactly. And she shares with Masson, the painter, he's talking about his, like, finding his ideal woman and things like that. She also is then encouraged to talk about, like, her past love. And she tells a story about a man that she fell in love with, but she decided to leave him because he had a silly last name and she couldn't stand the idea of being called Madame Dam. And that's when you're like, oh my gosh. Yvonne and Simon Dam had a life together in the past. So basically they both meet together in Rochefort. And then Yvonne is basically like tempted away by this like wealthy man who promises to give her this, you know, beautiful, bright, fun, festive life in Mexico. And so she leaves Simon and he's like left heartbroken and he lived in Paris for a long time, and then he came to Rochefort. He tells Solange earlier in the movie that he came to Rochefort to live his memories, to sit and dwell on the past, because this is where he met his true love. And so that's when you, the viewer, are like, oh my gosh, these two people.
And he has no hope of actually finding her. He's given up. Yeah, he's just trying to live in the past.
He thinks she's in Mexico, but she never went to Mexico. She's here with her twin daughters.
And a young son. Quality parenting throughout.
Yeah. Parenting is more of a concept than a reality in this film. But you're like, oh my gosh, these two people were in love in the past. They're in the same town now. And neither of them have any idea the other person is there. So that's kind of that first, like, aha connection. Another character we meet is Yvonne's young son, Bubo, who is like about 10 or 11.
Ooh.
9, I think.
Do they say that?
They say that it's been 10. Listen.
Say it's been 10 years.
In the subtitles, Dam says it's been 10 years since he last saw his fiancée Yvonne, which means that if my maths, then Bubo has got to be 10, but he does look like he's like 7.
He acts like he's like 7.
He acts, any 10-year-olds who behave like that need some more attention in their lives, clearly. Though Bubo gets ignored a lot throughout this movie.
Also less champagne in their life.
Oh yeah, Bubo. he does love the champagne. Anyway, we're getting ahead. We meet him. He basically one of the reoccurring events in the story as we follow basically the week leading up to this carnival is different people get sent to pick up Bubo from school. So the first day, the two carnies who are hanging out in Yvonne's cafe, she sends them to go pick up her son because she's like, no one else can go because the twins are busy.
So let's trust some carnies that we've never met before with our child.
Let's just send two strange men that I met for the first time today, one of which with some very nice eyeliner, to go pick up my child. No, what could go wrong? Anyway, but as it turns out, the twins thought ahead, and so Delphine is actually there to pick up Bubo. But then she also is just like, yeah, when she runs into the Carneys, she's like, yeah, you can take him.
Makes my life easier.
Makes my life more convenient. So she like, because she's running errands and she's on her way to see Guillaume. So she just leaves him with these Carneys. And Bobo comes to no harm. He has bought candy and is, for all intents and purposes, has a wonderful time this week. The best week of his life.
He is consistently a little shit to everyone around him.
He is the worst. He fights in school. He complains all the time. He jumps on tables. Another character who sort of comes in and out of the story is Monsieur Dutroux, who is this elder man who is friends with one of the regulars at Yvonne's cafe. And he sort of comes in and out throughout the story in many of the cafe scenes. But not a lot of attention is paid to him, but it's worth mentioning right now. It's a secret tool that will help us later. Again, hinging around people going to pick up Bubo. The next day, Delphine and Solange are talking, and Delphine is like, oh, I let these two carnies pick up Bubo from school. And Solange is like, what are you doing? Why would you do that? Which I thought was very funny. And she says this very funny line where she's like, the city is filled with soldiers, carnies, and like artists or something like that. It's very funny.
Yeah.
Solange takes it upon herself to go and pick up Bubo. And the carnies have come again to pick him up from school because they were like, well, Yvonne's busy and we might as well go help. They're very like very chill people.
They've got nothing better to do until their show.
Yeah, like, and a lot of the characters in this movie are just very chill people going through life. So Solange is, she runs into them and she's like, why are you here? Like, I'm here to pick up Bubo. And then he's a little, how should I put this? The worst. And he wants to go with the carnies because they buy him candy and things like that. And while he's being ridiculous, he knocks Solange's bag out of her hand, into the street. Her music's everywhere. Disastrous. And she starts to try and like tidy up the papers. And then her hand touches the hand of a stranger who has come to help. And she looks up.
An American.
She looks into the eyes of, who could it be? Gene Kelly.
Star power.
And they stare into each other's eyes. It's very lovely. And then he's like, are you a musician? And she's like, yes. And he's like, can I see you again? And she goes, maybe, but probably never. Very Cinderella. And she just like leaves. And while she's in a hurry to leave, she like drops a piece of music on the ground. Again, it's an important tool for later.
which he picks up and starts reading.
Yes. And then he starts singing. I love how they sing. There's so much scale singing in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. He starts singing and dancing because what do you do when you fall in love, Kyle? You sing and dance in the street.
You immediately sing and dance through the streets.
Then you jump into your car and look backwards while you drive down the street. Not even a concern. Forward. In a musical, you drive forward while looking backwards, because in a musical, you don't need to worry about hitting other people, lampposts, or anything, because you're in love. Anyway, he has a very snazzy car, I will also note. But we digress.
In many ways, this is also a reference to Roland Cassard's giant Cadillac in Lola, while he's driving around in love, looking for love.
And so, then we get another musical number about Solange finding her true love. Delphine also sings about how she now knows that there's a man out there who's for her. Because here's the thing, she knows that there is a painter out there who is in love with her. And she wants to find him, but she can't find him. And it's amazing that if all of these characters just had a few conversations, the pieces would slide into place. Because if the girls talked to their mother, Yvonne could be like, oh, I know a painter. Like, it would be so easy.
I often find myself in situations where I just want to scream at people, both in real life and fiction, of communicate.
Talk about your lives, darn it. Anyway. So then, while all this has been happening, the two carnies, with nothing better to do, have returned to their, where they've been setting up for the carnival, and the two of the performers, / potential girlfriends, it's not totally clear.
They are girls who are in their vicinity, who are dancing for their show, who, I never got the impression that there was anything romantic there.
Yeah.
there's definitely attraction, and it's all very superficial. And I think we're supposed to perceive it as superficial.
Yeah, they basically just tell the carnies that they're actually going to leave the show to run away with sailors. And there's another dance number. But Etienne and Bill, the carnies, are like, well, okay, that's cool, I guess. And then they go because they need to get other performers to now perform at their carnival.
To dance and perform to show the to sell their motorcycles.
And who better to ask to perform for their show than the two really beautiful twins they ran into while trying to pick up their younger brother from school? Who else could it be? No one. So they go to get the girls, see if the girls will do it. And the twins say yes after messing around with them quite a bit. Again, an incredibly fun musical number.
It's so lavish and delightful. Like, oh my gosh.
And the twins agree that they will do the performance. And this is kind of where the pieces start to slide towards each other, come together a little bit better. It's revealed in the newspapers that a woman has been brutally murdered in like a completely out of left field moment in the story.
It's a violent tone shift in contrast to the rest of this movie in ways kind of bringing us out of the idealism of the film. She's been literally hacked up by a scorned lover.
Yeah.
By an unrequited love.
Yeah, it goes from like characters singing about how like I could describe his face and his hands and the love on his face and like all this to being like, and this man hacked a woman into pieces, put her in a basket, and the blood ran into the street. Like, it was just a tonal, like, whiplash where you're just kind of like...
It's very clearly intentional that you're like, whoa!
And it's very interesting because the characters are kind of like, oh. And then they go back to singing. Like, you, the viewer, are left being like, okay, a lady was hacked to death? And the characters are like, on to the next musical number. Don't worry about it.
Also, the lady's name is Lola.
Yes, Lola.
You have to wonder if this is the Lola from Demi's first film. Of course, later we see Lola in a film set in America, so we don't fully know whether this is just a tongue-in-cheek joke by Demi, or we're actually intended to understand this as Lola's destination.
So, the character played by Gene Kelly, who has now been wandering the streets looking for love with this piece of music... Turns out that he is actually Andy Miller, and he has actually come to Rochefort to see Simon Dam because they were friends together in school and he wants to catch up with him. So he's kind of wandering through the streets looking to find his music store because obviously he doesn't have Google Maps.
Or a sense of direction.
Or a sense of direction because this town cannot be that big and he has a car, which is more than most of the any other characters have. But... to each their own. To be fair, he is shown literally driving, looking at the sheet music, and singing the sheet music. So, for all we know, he's driving around the same building in just a big square. And we would never know. And that's okay. So, the characters are kind of hurrying to get on with their lives. And it's very, in a very funny sequence of events, characters that we want to meet don't meet. Miss each other
by seconds.
Yeah, miss connections by seconds where the painter Maxon is leaving town for a few days before he's officially discharged from the army. Before he is discharged from the Navy, he and Solange run into each other at the site where the murder was. And then they have a brief conversation where he realizes that she is one of the twins that is one of Yvonne's daughters. And she remembers him because Yvonne has spoken about him before. Again, this is their first time meeting, though. But as we know, Delphine is the one for Masson, but he is not. She's not there to meet him. Yeah. He meets the wrong twin, so to speak.
He even talks about his idealized woman.
He does.
This obsession of his.
And Solange is...
like, that's nice.
She's like, that's nice. Anyway, see you. And then so he leaves. And then seconds later, he runs into Andy Miller, who is looking for Solange but they just have like a casual conversation, and then he keeps walking because he's in a hurry. And then Andy Miller runs into Delphine, who's been shopping for costumes for the show. And then they have like a nice brisk conversation. And it's so funny because she walks onto the sidewalk literally seconds after Masson walks away. And so if he just stayed a few seconds, because he says, I'm in a rush, I have to catch my train, it's at 1 p.m. If he just stayed for a minute, he would have found his true love. But no. So it's a very funny sequence of events where people miss each other by seconds. Eventually, Delphine takes pity on the directionally challenged Andy Miller and sends him to the correct place. And he goes to see Simone Dame, and they have a reconnection, and Andy plays the song that he found in the street for Monsieur Dame. And you get a really funny moment where he's like, I've heard this song before. Literally, like, he'd heard it yesterday.
Yeah.
Yesterday
But
afternoon.
No actual connection.
He's just like, I could have sworn I've heard this somewhere before. But anyway, then he tells Andy about how he knows this young girl who's this composer who he wants to send a writer letter of recommendation to him about. But he doesn't say her name. And there's like this, you know, clearly he's talking and Andy's telling him about how he's met this girl of his dreams in the street and they met eyes and whatever. They're talking about the same girl. They're talking about Solange. But neither of them realize it. And you, the viewer, are just like, oh, my gosh. And then we get to the day of the show. There is a little dinner scene beforehand.
Yeah, there is a dinner scene. It also feels like it also feels very much like it is a reference to the Fox musicals, but this kind of very gamey misconnection aspect.
Yeah. And what I like about it is it's like almost harmless misconnections. Like people brush on and off of each other very like casually in this movie, but no one's directly unhappy. Everybody's just kind of vibing, you know, going through life. And I like that a lot. So there's a dinner scene where almost everyone's together, but if you keep, Masson's not there, so he's not there to meet Delphine. And Monsieur Dutroux makes a random appearance where he's seen the art in the gallery, and he's like to Delphine, he's like, I've met you before, like I could have sworn. And she's like, no, you haven't. I never forget a face. And then he's really hesitant about cutting the cake. It's a secret tool we'll come back to later. So then we get to the actual carnival. This is a beautiful, like, just really fun set of, like, dances.
It's grand. It's
huge.
You know, it's interesting because in Umbrellas of Cherbourg, we have a sequence where we see a street carnival like this happening, and the characters kind of remark that it's annoying. Here, we revel in it. It is bold. It is colorful. It is chaotic. Everything is happening.
Several different dance routines are taking place, including some of the students from Delphine and Solange's music studio are performing at the carnival. One of the dances I do want to highlight quickly is a bunch of young guys who are dressed as basketball players doing like a dance number around basketball. And all I have to say is that was very High School Musical of them. This was the blueprint. No.
To me, also likes men in short tight clothing dancing.
Men in shorts, but I was also like, Troy from High School Musical would lose his mind over this. Anyway, so Solange and Delphine give their big number. It's a wild success. They look gorgeous in these matching red dresses. It's lovely. And importantly to note, again, frustrated missed connections. Yvonne doesn't come to see the performance because she's at the cafe. But Simone Dame comes to see them. Guillaume comes to see them. These people are present, but it's not the right people at the right place. To clarify, the twins agreed to do this show with the Carneys because the Carneys offered to give them passage to Paris, basically a ride over to Paris. So it's a little transactional. But after the performance, the Carneys are like, hey, we're in love with you. We want to sleep with you. which is like literally the what they say.
Spelling it out. Spelling it out.
They kept it very clear. And the twins are basically like, your love is not the kind of love we're looking for. And then walk away.
They do pause and consider it, though.
They do think about it. And like, I respect. Because Etienne and Bill are serving a look.
They are attractive guys.
They are like so pretty. I was like, this is some very pretty men. But Etienne and Bill, they're disappointed, but they're not too put out by it. And they all agree to meet up tomorrow to head to Paris. And now we come to the final moments of the story. The morning paper comes out and we learn that, first of all, the killer was Monsieur Dutroux. Are just very calm, quiet gentleman who's been coming into the cafe and in and out of the story. He was the killer who hacked the dancer Lola to death.
And everyone's like, oh, that's interesting gossip.
Yeah, again, we the viewer are like, oh my gosh, slashed to death, like, ah. And Yvonne literally goes, that rat, to the screen, and then like moves on. You know, like they treat it more as like a gossip topic. Simon Dam comes to visit the twins and tells Solange that she must go to his music studio immediately because Andy is here to like see her, or it was here in town visiting, and that he wants her to meet him right away so they can form that connection. He's thinking about her musical career. So Solange is leaving, but Delphine and Solange are supposed to be leaving to Paris that day. And in all the chaos, they forgot, oh, we have to go pick up Boo Boo. So Simon Dam offers to go pick up Boo Boo for them. And then Delphine says that she will go say goodbye to Yvonne for the twins. Which is, wow.
Moving
imagine
away.
Your,
and
imagine your twin daughters just sends one to go say goodbye for both of them.
Yeah. Wow. That's a moment.
And they don't even mind. Always think
that, I've seen this movie a dozen times and it always makes me laugh.
No, the way Delphine's like, I'll just say goodbye for both of us. And I was like, okay, all right. You guys realize you're leaving, right? Anyway. So then Delphine goes to the cafe to say goodbye to Yvonne on behalf of her and her sister. And her mother's like, who's going to go pick up Boo Boo? And she's like, oh, Simon Dam's going to pick up Boo Boo. And then you see, finally, someone says someone's freaking
off.
Name. And Yvonne's like, oh my gosh, I have to go. And for the first time in the movie, Yvonne leaves the cafe.
And she leaves Delphine at the cafe. So Delphine now cannot leave to go get ready to go meet the boys.
Yeah. And it's one thing to note is Monsieur Masson is back in town, the painter. He's officially discharged. He's in civilian clothes and he stops by to say hello to Yvonne to talk about the paper. And then he leaves his bag in the cafe and he walks away. Then we get the most frustrating scene in the movie where one of the regulars at the cafe calls for Yvonne to bring like the paper to him. But Yvonne's not there. It's just Delphine. So Delphine picks up the paper. And I kid you not, in this shot, we see her walk past the counter and go into the back to, like, get the paper or give the paper to him. Maxon walks in, picks up his bag, walks out just as she's walking back towards the counter. It's, oh.
It's amazing visual comedy.
It's so funny. But you're also like, y'all. And then, meanwhile, in a more satisfying set of meetings, Solange arrives at the music store and finally
meets her love,
her love at first sight, and they dance in front of a very lovely upright piano.
It's just a beautiful number.
It's so beautiful. I love the way the concerto that Solange has like composed in the story plays an important part in the soundtrack and in the songs throughout the
movie. It's a theme.
Movie.
Yeah, it's a theme
beautiful theme.
The
again, another happy moment. Simon Dam and Yvonne get to finally make that connection again when she goes to pick up Boo Boo.
It's pure joy.
They're so happy to see each other again. Like, you think there'd be baggage, but not in this movie. They're just like,
no.
Ah! It's like the
love.
A total polar opposite to Umbrellas of Cherbourg, where it's like, oh, it's been years since I've seen you. What do I even say? In this movie, they're just like, I'm so happy to see you again.
And, you know, he gets to meet Boo-Boo as well. His son.
He does. His son. Again, that part's kind of glossed over. This is a comedy movie, in case you can't tell. It's supposed to be funny. And then we get another wonderful dance sequence with everything kind of building up to the finale. And it ends with Delphine leaving with the Carnies without Solange. She's kind of confused why Solange isn't there, but she decides to go with them to Paris anyway. Interestingly, the waitress at the cafe who works for Yvonne, who has been a consistent character throughout the story, she's just been like a background like person there minding the cafe, comes out of nowhere and is like, I would like to come to Paris. And Etienne and Bill, who are chill as all get out, are like, yeah, why not? Get in. They do not
care. Traveling with Carnies. It's pretty, yeah.
They were like, all right, let's go. And so they drive away and say goodbye to Rochefort and leave. It leaves Simon Dam and Yvonne and Solange and Andy behind. Delphine is kind of alone now at this point. And as they're driving, who did they pass? A strange blonde hitchhiker on the road. Turns out it's Monsieur Masson, who has the painter. He missed his train, I believe, and he's walking on the side of the road, and he puts out his thumb to catch a ride with the carnival, and they pick him up, and yeah, that's kind of where the movie ends. I personally like to believe that Delphine and Masson travel in the same carnival for hours, maybe days, and continue to not run into each other. But I think we are maybe left to believe that they do finally meet. But
they're going to Paris. It's even said earlier they'll meet each other on like one of the boulevards. Like,
yeah,
if it doesn't happen in the carnival.
Yeah, and throughout the story, Delphine has been pressing Guillaume to tell her who the painter is, and he's been blocking her at every turn because he's bitter. But she says to him, she's like, I'll find him, even if I have to go all the way to like Germany. So you're left feeling like they'll meet each other one day, but for now, it's the missed connection.
And one day, but you have a clear sense that one day that will probably work out sooner rather than later with them traveling together.
We hope. We can only hope. I would have happily watched a whole sequence of them like driving to Paris and just continuing to miss each other at very obvious parts.
We end with these big dramatic shots of them leaving on the carrier bridge over Rochefort, which is something we see in other Demy films. And it's just a lovely... This film is so fun. Demy is having fun with the ideas of what a musical can be.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, minutia with the characters, because they're all... There's a lot of characters running into each other, and so the plot can get a little... I wouldn't say hard to follow, because it's very straightforward, but it's so, like, fun, and he does such a wonderful job of weaving these characters into one another that, like, again, it's just a good vibe of a movie. Like, we're here for a good time.
It's not necessarily plot-driven. You're just vibing.
You're just vibing with a little bit of a horrific murder thrown in there unexpectedly.
Just to bring back reality.
I think one of the biggest things that stands out to me in this movie is the color, the use of color, and how...
They painted the entire city.
Literally. And so many of the shots are carefully composed to be this beautiful picture. Like, if you were to pause this movie...
Everything is a painting.
Everything is a picture. It's beautiful.
Everything is vivid and bright and clean.
And again, super composed. Like, everything is very detailed, very carefully structured, very clearly designed to be the way that it is.
Even the wardrobe is just impeccably designed. Color coordinated. Everything's working on... Everything's firing on all cylinders to really... make it punchy and vibrant and feel lively.
Everybody's outfits are so color coordinated. It's so cute. Like, the twins each have their own, like, colorful outfits that, like, complement each other, but also themselves. Everybody has their own palettes. Everything's super bright. Like, it's just...
it's a visual feast.
It's so pretty to watch.
It's also just joyful music. Like, the music is so catchy, is so... you can't help but smile during this film.
Yeah, it's also, like, it's a very happy movie. Again, it's a big contrast to The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, because this movie is very, like, simple, happy, finding love kind of story. It's not as... it doesn't go in as deep emotionally with things, but it treats love as a very, like, light thing.
Also, while Cherbourg is an opera where we never really acknowledge the fact that the characters are singing all these parts, this is a traditional musical. They will literally break out into song and dance in consistently throughout the entire thing. It's very much in the style of Broadway. And that allows a lot of play and a lot of fun. People are having a good time, and there's these large, lavish musical numbers that not only allow us to see their joy and see their aspirations and express all these different characters at once, but also allows Demme to really show off his filmmaking with these gigantic, like, crane shots and dolly shots and a real sense of scale that we don't get in his other films. It's pretty clear the production took over the entire town. We have just gigantic rigging that we see establishing these stunning vistas. And again, this is all happening in a real town. These are real places. This is a real town square. This is all very practical production when the Fox musicals that he's emulating were done on giant sound stages. So it's a real, like, testament to the skill and craft they had to be able to pull off these massive scale productions.
And again, the soundtrack is so catchy, so happy. Absolutely just perfectly ties the film together.
Yeah.
I can't even, like, find good word. It's just perfect. Like, I love the soundtrack so much. And again, the songs, like I was saying earlier, like, they can only be sung in French. You cannot translate that and get the same effect.
They are fast-paced. Very, very easy to follow French. It's very clearly enunciated and easy to follow, but they are fast-paced. And there's also a lot of, like, French alliteration. There's a lot of things going on linguistically that don't necessarily translate well.
Yeah, plays on words, things like that. That, yeah, they would just not, it wouldn't work the same. But kind of like we were talking about at the beginning, this film kind of talks about the three different types of love, you know, finding that love that you'd lost before and reconnecting with it after time's passed. Then you have Solange and Andy, you know, love at first sight. And then you have Delphine and Maison, who are like just love that you could have, but you're always missing because you're at the wrong place at the wrong time.
The potential for love.
And the movie's very light, but still interesting with those different types, following those different love stories and the interweaving characters.
And again, like Cherbourg, does not discriminate or cast opinion on the value of these different types of love. It's not infantilizing to the love at first sight. It's not, you know, cynical about the reunited love. It's just experiencing joy from all these characters having joyous things happening to them.
Yeah.
I also think it's interesting that this is a film made at peacetime for France. You know, we are in the aftermath of the Algerian War. There is no major conflict that France is involved in. And that tone is very palpable. In especially how the sailors are portrayed, but also just throughout the entire mood, people are truly carefree and joyous. It shows, even when we're, like, seeing these amazing, like, missed opportunities between couples and your heart is invested in their love, it's able to keep everything very light, and you believe that all these characters will have a good life no matter what happens to them. Nothing is consequential.
Yeah, none of the characters are unhappy with their lives or the people in their lives. And again, it's really funny seeing the combinations of characters who have information that they should share with other characters in order for those characters to meet and make connections earlier. But because they don't say anything, you get so many situational comedy moments where characters are talking about other people, have this information that they don't even know that they have and are just constantly missing opportunities to, bring people together or give the vital information.
It's just so cozy.
It is cozy.
Everything is, even when you have like bittersweet things happening, everything is just so light and cozy that you're able to really drink in the music, drink in the characters, drink in the world, drink in this idealized little French city. It's also very progressive in some ways. We have, shotgun marriages. We have infidelity. We have lost love reunited. We have single mothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot of social commentary that we can draw in how relationships are portrayed here.
Yeah, and again, with, a single mother being, like, the main parental figure in the movie, going back to what we were talking about in Cherbourg.
We have no reliable father figure in these films, period.
Simon Dam really pulls up to a town that has his literal son in it, doesn't even know. Anyway.
And then he's like, oh, you come with the package. Cool.
Yeah, the story does not really talk about, like, emotional consequences of finding out you've had a kid for 10 years and not known about it.
Nope.
Boo-Boo is just there. He's there to not want licorice, but want other candy and knock people's portfolios into the street.
And drink all the champagne.
Though technically, yes, he also goes through a whole bottle of champagne at the dinner party, which, like, what a legend. Anyway, live fast, die young. I guess you could attribute, though, him throwing Solange's portfolio into the street as the reason that Andy and her meet. So I guess we can give him credit. We can give him a little piece of credit.
Yeah.
But other than that, he's a terror in this movie.
What do we think about realism in this film? Because it creates this very, like, artificial world. It's an idealized world. And the only, like, I think one of the reasons that the murder subplot feels so grounding and sudden is there's no sense of realism outside of those moments.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we think that Demi made this choice to have this, disconnected reality?
That's an interesting question. I saw in an interview where he was talking about, like, the kind of, like, mindsets or ideas that he was bringing to each of his projects. And when he was talking about The Young Ladies of Rochefort, he was like, I just want people to leave the theater, like, singing and dancing or whatever.
Yeah.
And, like, this idealized world, even though it is an ideal and even though it does not directly reflect real life, the shutters on your windows are not color coordinated, and when you dance in the street with your girlfriend, you're not both wearing complementary colors.
Yeah.
But everything is so minute and everything is so detailed in this movie that it feels so real, even though it's decidedly a fake crafted ideal world. But honestly, like, I think he just wanted people to
have a good time,
feel good watching this movie, and that's okay to go to a movie and feel good while watching it.
Cinema.
Yeah.
It also has, like, a dreamlike quality. In many ways, it could be perceived that the escapism is a response to the realism that, we're seeing, especially in the UK in this period of the 60s. We're starting to see these very grounded kitchen sink stories take a lot of attention. And he's harkening back almost to a previous time in how he's doing this lavish production.
It's a No Thoughts, Just Vibes movie.
It's a pure No Thoughts, Just Vibes movie. And it does that perfectly. The execution.
It has one goal and it does it very well. It delivers on its merits very well, and nothing more needed to be said. So I guess now that brings us to our third movie of the episode, which is La La Land, which takes a lot of cues from Demi's films and is a American musical film that came out in 2016. And there's a lot of interesting parallels to draw slash discuss with this movie?
It came out in November 2016.
It was a long time ago for me.
When we frame this, we have to remember that it screened for the press the same week as the results of the 2016 election came out.
Oh, that's a good point.
And it was released a week later. So that's an interesting framing of when we're talking about escapist cinema. Some people really enjoy escapism. Some people find it very grating when real world events are pressing down on them. It also competed in the awards season with some very serious realist films like Barry Jenkins' Moonlight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's kind of an odd duck to have this big, lavish Demi-style musical against some very, very, very serious social commentary films. It's directed by Damien Chazelle, who had previously done Whiplash. Chazelle makes no bones about being obsessed with Demi's work. He even calls it a pseudo-remake of Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The songs are by Pasek and Paul, frequent collaborators with Chazelle. And it stars Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone, and John Legend as our main players. The film has a 91% on Rotten Tomatoes, and Lionsgate is distributing it worldwide on 4K Blu-ray. It's also streaming on the Starz streaming service. As far as award success, it had an incredible 11 Oscar nominations. Most notably, it was nominated for Best Picture, where it was mistakenly announced as the Best Picture winner instead of Moonlight, who actually won. I remember that vividly because I had no power during those Oscars, and my little battery on my iPad was going down, and I wanted to save it. So when they announced La La Land won, I shut the stream off and did not find out till the next day.
That's amazing. You just spent a whole, 12 hours thinking that.
I was solidly pro
Moonlight. Angry Twitter post.
So I even made a whole,
can't believe.
Angsty.
And then yes. It turned out, actually, Moonlight did win.
Yeah, no, that's, which it was also, won Best Director for Damien Chazelle and Best Actress for Emma Stone, in addition to a whole ton of nominations.
Yeah. Emma Stone slayed in this movie, I will just say.
Oh, she's great. Also, Ryan Gosling's great. He's all of the music performance you see is real.
Yeah.
We have actual musicians playing their instruments. Ryan Gosling, who is a classically trained pianist, had to learn how to play in a jazz style, which is not easy.
Yeah.
And he commits. All of the music performance is genuine performance. And that's really incredible.
Yeah, there's a lot of dedication to the creation of the film here. And I really appreciated that.
So the story of La La Land is pretty light. it's your traditional, romance musical. We begin in L.A. With our two characters. We have Sebastian, who goes by Seb, and we have Mia. Seb is a jazz pianist. Mia is an aspiring actress, and they're both kind of living that early L.A. career dream story. They are struggling to get a foot in anywhere. Entirely disconnected from the plot of the film, we begin with this incredible musical number in traffic on an L.A. overpass. And Seb and Mia are both present, but we don't feature them at all. This is truly a spectacle. It's the thing I remember more than anything else about this film. We then transition to their stories. They're road raging at each other and just kind of have this ongoing misconnection thing going on. Mia is working on the Warner Brothers lot at a coffee shop and has a number of bad additions where the casting director just does not care what's going on in her life. We then transition to her roommates who are all equally living this dream of being successful in Hollywood. And, one by one have this fear of not succeeding and having to go home, having to return to their prior life because the dream did not become reality. Her roommates take her on to this lavish influencer party that's happening in the hills where, you're supposed to be networking and meeting people. But Mia isn't willing to play this game and kind of is a bit of a loner. Her car gets towed from the party, so she winds up having to walk home on her own. We then transition over to Seb's story, where he is working a fairly depressing gig as a pianist at a restaurant doing horrible jazz Christmas music. He keeps bursting into improvisation, playing his own things, and the manager at the restaurant is quite at the end of his rope with this kind of creativity. This is not the place for that. They want him to play the set list. This these very simple arrangement of these Christmas tunes that that everyone has heard to death. Mia overhears him playing as she passes by and enters the restaurant, transfixed by the sound of his jazz improv. And she walks in just as Seb has been fired for not obeying the set list. And he is kind of a jerk. He literally runs into her and she starts to compliment him and he just brushes past. Months go by. Mia is now at another one of these kinds of very fake influencer parties where Seb is playing in an 80s pop cover band.
We all have our new lows.
He's playing guitar.
We all have our struggles.
He's playing the guitar in an 80s pop cover band. I love, there's a whole lot going here because the band is taking requests and to kind of push his buttons. She requests Iran. Oh, he is literally pained by this request. After their gig, they're kind of walking to their cars. She's receiving unwanted attention from another guy and takes an opportunity to have conversation with Seb as a way to escape that. And they wind up kind of lamenting the Hollywood dream and have this beautiful number up against the Griffin Observatory about what Hollywood means and what meeting people means, what this moment means. But the night must come to an end and they separate and go their own ways. Seb comes to meet Mia at the coffee shop and they wander around the Warner Brothers back lot, kind of discussing their dreams and passions. There's a bunch of discussion about what the idea of Hollywood means and what its potential is and all the dreams that have been dashed over the years. He then takes her out to a jazz club and talks about his passion for the idea of jazz and its history. And he wants to open his own club to save jazz from losing its roots. We'll touch on that later. He then invites her to the cinema to see a film repertory showing of Rebel Without a Cause. And she accepts, forgetting that she has a date with her boyfriend, Greg, who's been out of town. And in the musical number with her roommates, we literally hear her say she's been meaning to break up with him. The date is boring. It's not going well. She walks out and goes to join Seb, who she stood up at the theater. The screening falls apart due to head warp with the film, where the film literally melts before their eyes. And they spend the rest of the evening wandering around Griffith Park and Griffith Observatory having this romantic number. We see more of Mia's life. We see failed auditions, and she's really not getting anywhere. So Seb encourages her to write a one-woman play. He's beginning to perform regularly at a jazz club. They move in together. They start to, truly be in love. This is when an old musician friend of Seb, Keith, who's played by John Legend, invites Seb to start playing keyboard in the jazz fusion band he's starting. This would provide steady income, give him a lot of security, and the chance to actually play his music and show his art to a large audience. He's conflicted by his own sense of integrity and the idea of selling out, the idea of being able to perform at that cost. He doesn't like the music. He doesn't like what jazz fusion means for jazz. He doesn't like the fans, quite frankly. But Mia convinces him to try something, to do something, both directly through her own inference and through how she's having to defend his actions to other people who are concerned about him being kind of a deadbeat. The band finds large success touring. They're scheduled to be touring throughout the next couple years. He's barely around. But Seb is kind of living a very false life. He doesn't seem actually happy. Mia accuses him of losing track of what truly mattered to him. They have this giant fight. A few weeks later, Mia's play is debuting, and Seb misses it because he has a photo shoot scheduled that he'd forgotten about for the band. The play has tepid reaction. It didn't make much money. Not a lot of people showed up, and Mia is heartbroken and pissed at Seb for not showing up. So when he comes afterwards to try to console her, she's not having it. And that's when they finally reach a breakup point. And Mia gives up on her dream and moves back to her hometown in Nevada. We fast forward a period of time. And Seb receives a phone call from a casting director who is trying to locate Mia because they haven't been able to get a hold of her. This casting director saw Mia's play and wants to give her a proper audition for an upcoming project. he immediately drives to Boulder City, Nevada, and tries to persuade Mia to come with him to try to give another go of the dream. And she reluctantly agrees at the last minute. This is where we really see Mia find her true dream in the audition, where it's a process piece. They don't have a script for her. They just ask her to tell a story. So she starts singing. What we're told at the start is singing about her aunt, who was a stage actress who died a pretty dark death of addiction, but then morphs into a story about what is a performer, what are dreams, what is potential, and why do we do what we're doing as performers. And it's this really incredible number with a lot of production. And she blows away the agent, she books the movie, and Seb is happy for her. And they do not get back together. That's the crucial thing. At this moment, they do not get back together. They both go their own ways. And then, much like Umbrellas of Cherbourg, we do a time jump. It is now 5 years later. We are back on the Warner Brothers lot, where Mia is now a notable actress who is being driven around the lot by a staffer. She is married to a different man, played by Tom Everett Scott. She has a daughter. She seems happy. It seems a bit superficial, but she seems happy. So one night, her and her husband are supposed to be going to a showing, but they're stuck in the Los Angeles cliche, endless traffic, so they get off at an exit and stumble into a jazz bar. As soon as she sees the logo of this new jazz bar, she knows this is Seb's place. It is the logo she had once designed for him. And he immediately notices Mia in the crowd. So as the band that's playing finishes up, Seb takes over the piano and plays this composition he had written for her. And we see a very idealized version of what their life potential could occur in this dream sequence that happens, essentially. There are explicit references to Umbrellas of Cherbourg and Young Girls of Russia 4 here. We see the gas station from Cherbourg restyled as an American Esso station. We see young sailors in the exact outfits from Young Girls of Russia 4. We see a young boy holding a red balloon. There's a lot of references here to how Chazelle romanticizes French cinema, as these two are kind of exploring the love that they could have had, but the dream sequence ends. They both acknowledge each other from a distance before going their own ways. And that's really how it ends.
For me, this movie feels like it's, again, a love movie, but instead of it being just a love between people, it's like the love that you have for a person and then the love that you have for the dream or your art or your career.
Yeah.
And how you are your often passion. Forced to choose between the two. And this one tells a story about two people who like loved each other, but loved their passions and more. Enough to go their separate ways.
Yeah. This is also a love movie to Los Angeles. I mean, the name literally Lava Land. The way this film uses Los Angeles as a backdrop, we see so many sites of LA, and they're used actively in a way that feels like its own love letter to the city itself.
Yeah, and they do a really, I think, like, Chazelle does a really nice job of in, like what Demi does in Cherbourg and Rochefort, is an almost idealized version of LA. Like it does, it's hyper realized.
It's very clean. It's very,
very clean.
It's very beautiful.
Very pretty.
We have these iconic shots that you don't really have, you know, pollution or trash or anything. It's an idealized version of these iconic locations. There's also a lot of visual influence from Demi just in how her apartment is painted. Her apartment has these incredibly vibrant wallpapers throughout. Their dresses look like something straight out of Rochefort. The influence is almost heavy-handed throughout this movie.
One thing I struggled a little bit with this movie in comparison to Umbrellas and Young Girls is music was an important role in the movie, in that it's like a movie musical, but I felt like in this movie it was much more like the we stop the plot to sing kind of musical.
Yes.
Which was very different from the two Demi films, where music was an intrinsic part of the storytelling. I felt like with La La Land, the music wasn't really as important to the story. It was more like a decoration placed on top afterwards.
Absolutely. That it feels very superficial. And I think a lot of the beats of the story could work perfectly without the music. Now, the musical numbers are amazing.
Yeah, they're wonderful.
They're incredibly well done, but they're not of substance to the film. But also, I don't think the film has that much substance when you interrogate it. In the commentary track, Demi talks about a number of different... They considered cutting the first number.
You mean my favorite part of the movie?
Literally, the most memorable part of the movie, because it felt detached from the story. And that is a valid critique of all of these musical numbers, quite frankly. But they're really well-executed, wonderful musical numbers that we don't often see in cinema today. So it's kind of this contrast. I don't feel like the musical numbers are fleshed out enough to be a compelling musical, but I also don't feel like the romance story is fleshed out enough to be a compelling romance story.
Yeah, like which I don't know how long this movie is.
2 hours.
It feels longer. It feels longer, but yeah, in the sense, like, I personally didn't feel a very strong connection to Seb and Mia's relationship.
No.
So while I definitely found it very interesting that it's about two young people trying to make success out of their passions, there wasn't, for me, I didn't feel like a lot more beyond that to their relationship.
Demi tells the story of two people falling in love in half the time and is twice as effective in making you feel their love.
Yeah. And again, I really like the music in La La Land, but the lyrics and a lot of the songs are a lot more abstract and don't have a lot to do with anything that's really happening in the story in the way that Umbrellas and Young Girls does, which is not saying that musicals have to, but when you are making a movie musical, I expected it to be a little more plot value from the songs, because there's a lot of story you can tell through song, and you can reveal a lot of what you would find when characters are speaking dialogue to one another. You know, you know the old adage, you speak until you can sing, until you have to sing, and then after you sing, you speak again. There's so many things that you can reveal about a character through song that I felt like was a missed opportunity with this film.
You know, City of Stars is a great number that is a love letter to the city of Los Angeles, mm-hmm. but it doesn't feel, and to the aspiration of the dream, but it never feels like it's also supporting the relationship, which this is a romance movie. So you have this nice number, which I think we hear three times throughout the movie.
Yeah.
That is so obsessed with glorifying Hollywood, with glorifying the city, with, you know, painting these ideals about what life can be out here, but doesn't actually manage to tell us anything about the characters and where they are in that moment, other than their frustrations with lack of progress in their careers.
Yeah, and even if you're reading this movie because I think a valid reading of this movie as a love movie, maybe it's not about Seb and Mia's love. Maybe it is about their love for their passions. Again, you could still explore that love for their passions through the music, and you don't. So even if you're reading this as being the love between Seb and Mia being less important, and the love of passion and performance and the industry and Los Angeles as being the more important love story, the songs don't unpack that as much or deal with that as much.
They all feel very surface level, except The Fools Who Dream, which is the song Mia sings in the audition, which I think is actually quite an incredible number.
I do like that one.
It's very, it feels, it has heart. It expresses the pain of struggling in the industry. It's really absolutely incredible. The song The Fools Who Dream was entirely not lip-synced. It's not overdubbed. So we actually have Emma Stone singing, and there's a pianist off screen playing in pace with her performance. So it feels very stripped down. It's very genuine. It feels very heartfelt, because I think Emma Stone can connect with this struggle. She struggled for a long time before she was able to break out. And that's a fantastic piece of filmmaking. That scene is really memorable in how it's able to show through the facial expression and compelling acting that Stone has all of her thoughts on the struggles and the dream realized and the potential other paths and all of those who don't find success. That is, I think, this film at its strongest, where it's able to actually say, most people fail. Most people struggle here. Success is rare. Unfortunately, it doesn't actually have anything to say beyond that number. And as soon as it's over, we have, you know, the wrap up at Seb's, and we don't really have a real follow through from that. And I think that's where it feels the most inconsistent. With Sherberg, when we leave with these two characters having this really unfulfilled separation, we feel a lot of things, but unfulfilled isn't one of them. I feel intensely satisfied by where these two characters are and the story that was just told. Here, it just feels unfinished because I think part of it is that Mia's husband is so underdeveloped that it doesn't matter. You don't know if she's truly happy. In fact, you feel like she's not, but she's making a practical choice.
Yeah, it's like Mia was married with a daughter so that the narrative could be very definitive about being like, and they don't get back together again, you know? Because if Mia had been single and successful and back in Los Angeles and had walked into that jazz bar, then you could be conceivably like, well, they might get together. They could start again. But the reality is I think you could have had Mia be, you know, unmarried or whatever and still had them not end up together or even be implied to end up together. Because when you are choosing between like fame and success and your passion, your art, and also being in love, like there's not always space for both. And I do think this movie is very interesting in how it portrays that there isn't always space for both. In fact, I almost wish that we'd spent less time about Mia and Seb being missed connections. And I almost wish that we had started with them together in the movie and had just explored the intricacies of trying to balance both the love that you have for your partners and the people in your life, and also the love that you have for trying to make it in your field and in your passions. Because there could have been some really interesting dynamics there.
I'm someone who has worked both in touring music and has worked in television. These industries are incredibly destructive to relationships. You have to put your entire life on hold for productions. You know. So it's difficult to go out on tour for months at a time and not see someone. You're going to have to make compromises. And that's how you discuss that with your partner, how you are able to navigate that. And I feel like it's both not addressed at any depth, but also it's conveyed in a way in which we see the female character presented as if she's unrealistically nagging Seb about his commitments.
Yeah, when in reality, he hasn't even really communicated anything with her about the duration of touring with the band, the scope.
She wanted him to have success in a large band. That comes with consequences.
Yeah. One thing I do really like about this movie with the protagonists is I do like that they don't hold ill will towards one another for their successes in the industry. They're genuinely invested in one another being successful.
They're happy for each other. And we get a clear sense that they're happy with each other.
Yeah, like Seb literally drives all the way to Mia's hometown to make her go do this audition because he knows that this is her chance to make it. Mia encourages Seb to, you know, try join the band, but then also calls him out when he starts to give up on his passion, when he starts to just be obsessed with the band. She points out to him that he always wanted to start, you know, his jazz bar.
A club.
Yeah.
A club that is focused on honoring the history of jazz and, you know, the greats of the 50s and 60s, which jazz fusion is about as removed from as possible. And, you know, there's a whole lot to unpack there of a young white person of a fair amount of privilege. You know, he's broke, but it's clear he's from money, trying to educate people about jazz. I think that's one of the places where the film's message gets very murky and it could potentially be perceived as a white savior narrative.
Yeah, when he was like, I'm going to save jazz, I was like, okay, buddy, that's a lot. You could have just said, hey, I'm going to make a jazz club and share jazz. You're to save jazz? All right, that's a very, okay, all right.
And I think the film also does poke some holes in, gives some criticism of his character when we see John Legend's character be like, jazz is something that is active in life. You know, jazz is continuously changing and evolving to put the music from 50 years ago on a pedestal as an example, as kind of this gatekeeping example of what jazz is to defy what jazz is. So the film wrestles with this message, but I feel like ultimately it seems the racial politics of how they discuss jazz in this film is pretty uncomfortable to me.
Well, also, again, I feel like this movie covers a lot, but also covers nothing at all at the same time. There's not a lot of deep introspection into jazz, and there's not a whole lot of, like, jazz as music doesn't play as big a role in the movie as you would think it would, considering that one of the main characters is obsessed with jazz. It's his life.
It's kind of underwhelming, and also it's the kind of film where it feels like everything is very intentional and meant to be very deep, but it's, when you actually interrogate it, not actually that deep, which is very frustrating because it just feels performative at that point.
There are some thoughts and some vibes.
It doesn't feel very cohesive.
But yeah.
There's also a lot of discussion about class in the film that feels very surface level. You know, they're struggling to pay rent. They're struggling to live in a city, which is intensely difficult to afford. They're struggling to get that first gig that will actually allow them to live a healthy life. But there's no deeper discussion about the effects of that grind and the economic issues at root. It doesn't try to even hint at those deeper problems.
There's rarely, like, I don't think there's really any conversation about, like, money and the struggle. Like, the only, like, the source of Mia's, like...
We do get a bit about Seb being behind on rent.
There is a little bit about him being behind on
and
rent.
And having no car insurance.
Yeah. But other than that, like, you don't really...
It's superficial.
Yeah, it's...
There's no attempt to understand the systemic problems. And you could say, oh, it's a musical, it doesn't need that. But I feel like Demi's work, while it appears superficial, is able to have a more coherent critique of culture.
Yeah, and even aside from that, when in storytelling, when you're trying to portray characters that are, you know, struggling and trying for something, you really, like, I feel like the movie could have spent a little bit more time showing the struggle side of things, because I feel like for Emma Stone's character, Mia gets a few bad auditions, which are rough, yes, but not really consequential to her livelihood. I mean, she seems to be making rent comfortably with her barista job. Like, you're never concerned for her, you know, lifestyle, so to speak. She
just doesn't have a dream.
She doesn't have a dream. And then for Seb, again, I feel like we just don't spend enough time with these characters in their, like, day-to-day difficulties. For me to
Mia's
be...
living with how many roommates, and yet we barely see them outside of the big musical number.
John Legend's character barely, like, has no development. He just appears partway through the movie to be like, here's a band, you should join it. And then he gets, you know, a little bit of dialogue here and there, but he's not really a character.
It's all very surface level. And I think when we're talking about the criticism of this film not dealing with things like the racial politics or the economics better, it's important to acknowledge that this came out in a time when we suddenly had very heightened political discourse in this country. I think when Chazelle was first trying to get this produced, like 5 or 6 years before it actually happened, a lot of this would have been received better. I mean, the film was very popular. It no doubt did well. But I think a lot of the criticism that we've seen would have kind of been glossed over because of a different era. But this film did come out, you know, in the climate of the 2016 election. And we saw a lot of examination of racial sensitivity. We saw a lot of examination of economic sensitivity. So this big, lavish love letter to what can be perceived as both a white savior narrative, but also a bunch of lip service to the corporations behind the media industries of Los Angeles, kind of lands very hollow, especially viewing it in that context.
The timing of this, which I hadn't thought about really before, because I didn't see La La Land when it first came out, but I know a lot of people who did see it and had varying opinions on it. But yeah, I hadn't really thought about the timing with it coming out at the end of 2016. the impact that that would have on its reception.
I literally walked, actually, Matt, the former co-host of the show, and I literally walked directly from a showing of Moonlight to a showing of La La Land. So that is about as strong of a cultural whiplash moment I've ever had. And my takeaway was very negative at the time.
Mm.
Looking at it now, having looked at it in the concept of Demi making very clear in interviews that it is an homage to Demi, I have more appreciation, but at the end of the day, it feels very underbaked and it feels long in the middle. It's a bit of a slog to get through for me. It's not consistently visually entertaining enough to get by on that alone without the substance, and the substance is incredibly disappointing.
Yeah, it's a very nice movie, but it doesn't really leave you with anything either to think about or anything that is concrete. The only thing maybe you could explore is the question of the impact of industry, working in the industry, and the effect that it has on your personal life. But again, I think that story could have been unraveled and dissected in a much more interesting way than it was. So while I don't dislike this movie, we sound really negative. I don't dislike this movie, but it left me feeling very like neutral. Like I don't have a strong opinion on it. I do really like the City of Stars song as a song, not as a musical.
Oh yeah. The music is all exceptionally well written.
Yeah. The music is lovely, but it definitely left me in a different place than the other two movies did.
When I was preparing to rewatch the film, I hadn't seen it since its initial release, and I was kind of dreading it. I put it off to the last minute. And I found myself really getting into it until the second act. And then I got very bored.
Yes.
There's some severe pacing issues that are just frustrating because it feels like the spectacle runs out. And you're able to deal with it and make it through to, you know, Mia's success and the wonderful audition scene, which is absolutely engaging. And the rest of the movie finishes on a really nice note, but it just feels unpolished in the middle. And that's a real contrast to Demi's films, which feel so tight and so joyful. And there's never a moment of wandering.
Yeah, and honestly, like, I feel like the interesting qualities of Seb and Mia are purely carried through on the charisma of Gosling and Stone. The characters themselves are not very, there's really nothing there that's very interesting. It's just like purely like Stone and Gosling just bringing their own like charisma and personality, I feel like, to the roles, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. But with this movie, it kind of made me feel like the characters were a little underwritten.
Yeah, which is interesting because there's not much to the characters of Sherberg or Rochefort, but they're able to sell it better because you have these interconnecting stories and you have a more detailed conversation about their lives.
And the characters, well, in the case of Young Girls of Rochefort, where especially the characters are no thoughts, just vibes, the characters are part of the set. They're part of Rochefort. Yeah. You know, they're part of the imagery and the town and the colors and things like that. Whereas in La La Land, the characters should be more developed.
Another thing there is especially Rochefort tends to involve the entire city. It tends to feel very grand, as if everyone's connected. And La La Land is very isolating. It's these characters' story in their own world, in these iconic backdrops, separated from everyone else. And that could be social commentary on how isolating Los Angeles can be. I don't know. This film doesn't develop the idea in any meaningful way.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You are left with a kind of loneliness with La La Land that you don't get with the other two films. And that's a good point about, you know, it could be commentary, but it also might not be.
I feel like with Chazelle, I've yet to actually like one of his films, but I consistently like the idea of his films. The closest I've come to liking one of his films is Babylon, which I will kindly describe as a hot mess. But it's very bold and reaches for the stars in a lot of ways.
Yeah, this was my first Chazelle movie. And again, I do, like you said, I like the idea of this movie a lot, but I'm just left thinking about like other ways I would have wanted to have seen it realized, I guess.
Yeah.
Like I could have really gotten behind a little more down to earth story of like, you know, the day-to-day struggles of trying to make a break in the industry.
I think you would actually genuinely really enjoy Whiplash.
I think I would too. I love listening to video essays, and I watched and listened to an entire video essay on Whiplash and thought I would really like this movie. I just haven't gotten around to seeing it. Yeah, I like the idea of La La Land, but I found myself at the end a little sleepy and a little bit like, well, okay.
Yeah. And quite frankly, I listened to the commentary Chazelle did, and he portrayed a lot of indecision about what the film would look like, and also presented a lot of desiring to emulate things, but not a lot of clear vision for how he wanted his film to be. And that kind of confirmed to me a lot of my frustrations that these were directorial shortcomings of the film. I do think it's really interesting. Talk about the music. The music is delightful. And Pasek and Paul, who have done a number of musicals over the years, are going to be working with Greta Gerwig on the musical adaptation, the live-action musical of Snow White. So I'm very curious to see what they do with her and that kind of directorial vision.
Yeah. No, the music in this is lovely. And I feel like we haven't talked about it as much as with the other two films, just because I think, as we said before, the music is a little more detached from the narrative. But this music is beautiful, and
it's catchy. There's a bunch of earworms.
Super catchy. I've been singing. Yeah.
Another Day in Sun is delightful.
And I absolutely love that opening sequence. I love a good choreographed dance.
Oh, it's great. It puts you in such a good mood, and it doesn't. And I think the goodwill that the audience has because of the spectacle of that number doesn't have enough fuel to get them through the more lumpy parts of the story.
Yeah, I almost wish there had been more, I guess, larger numbers or more ensemble dances, because the only other big choreographed dance stuff involves Mia going to that party with her roommates. And I got a little frustrated watching that because it's so dark in the background that you almost can't appreciate the colors in the dancing. At least I felt like that.
Yeah, I could see that. It's also, both of those things occur in the first reel of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, we get that out of the way quick.
So maybe the solution is, if you don't write a really deep story with, like, carefully crafted characters, maybe do just add more dance numbers to it, and maybe that is the real movie takeaway lesson that we
get
from
everything has to be
from
deep.
The young girls of Rochefort. Maybe the solution is just dance.
On that note, we're going to come to a close on this episode. Definitely recommend checking out more Jacques Demy. All of his films that I've seen, which I've seen most of them at this point, are just delightful. And he's a very varied filmmaker. He produced films in three different countries. There's a lot to explore there. Some films are surprisingly dark in their portrayal of, you know, he's a child who grew up during the Second World War. But there's a lot of depth. Also, Agnès Varda's two films about his life, the feature film, the narrative film about his childhood, and then the documentary about his career, are really lovely, and I highly recommend them. As well as the documentary she made on the 25th anniversary of filming Young Girls of Rochefort, which is really lovely. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, Audible, and Spotify. Consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Audibles. That really helps us a lot. It helps people find the show, helps us get promoted on various platforms. It's really, really crucial that people are leaving those reviews. It means a lot to us.
And we really want to hear your feedback on your thoughts on these movies and things like that. So definitely leave a comment if you have, you know, did you love something in this movie? Do you disagree with something we said? Like, I would love to read these comments.
Yeah, hit us up on our social media. Next week, we'll be looking at kind of this loose theme of audio surveillance as a narrative device in films. We'll be starting with Francis Ford Coppola's classic film, The Conversation, then looking at Brian De Palma's thriller, Blowout, which is a loosely inspired reimagining of Michael Antonioni's Blow Up. And then we're concluding with Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck's The Lies of Others, which is a look at the East German secret police and their surveillance team. Thank you for joining us for another episode. We can't wait to see you.
In the meantime, maybe put on a little fun music and do a little dancing.